got the home of the truth. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I was reading The New Yorker. I'm not going to lie, I'm reading The New Yorker because Ralph Russo, our next guest, tweeted out that his wife, a veterinarian at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, is quoted in this New Yorker piece. And so we're going to talk some college sports, but we're also going to talk about Ralph Russo's very intelligent wife on today's show. How are you, my friend?
I couldn't be more excited. You did not prep me for this. So the fact that you are leading with my wife has me far more excited than just being asked. So did anything surprise you about the top 25?
I know.
Like, I am definitely down for this conversation. Yeah, she's incredibly impressive, many degrees, and is a person who is in her small way trying to save the world as a veterinarian in public health and an epidemiologist who just lived through a pandemic. So that was interesting living with her.
Yeah, give me an idea of what that was like for you, because the rest of us were kind of, you know, sitting around spitballing with people who really don't know. And you had across the table from you somebody who actually knew, you know, you didn't have to. Were you just asking her a lot of questions?
So there was a fair amount of that, obviously. I mean, especially for what we were doing as far as like whether college football season was going to be played. And I mean, there was so much wrapped up in what I was doing around the pandemic. Often I was like, so what do you think about this? And also, like, I'm writing and interviewing other doctors, and I don't want to stumble into saying something that's wrong. So I would occasionally vet things with her, like, hey, if I write this, is this okay? I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here. I'm not a science writer. I'm not a medical writer. But she was definitely a really good resource. And I will try to keep this, like, really short, John. Like, it really was like wild, like how she was giving me like, here's what's going to happen. And then a few weeks later it would happen.
Wow.
Right. Like, yeah, I was definitely getting, and to almost to the point where like, I don't know if I was really grasping it. Like, you know, she had a pretty good idea about, like in February that like we were in tough times. Like she had not exactly, I don't want to say, because there was still a ton of uncertainty, and that was part of the problem of why the pandemic was so difficult to deal with, because of all the uncertainty. And I think what experts will tell you is they acknowledge the definitely a little freaky of her, you know, coming to me and saying like happened, and then it did happen.
We're talking to Ralph Russo, Associated Press, covers college football. His wife works as a pathologist, is that correct? Or veterinarian works? What is her technical title?
So she's the public health veterinarian for the city of New York, and she's an epidemiologist.
Okay.
That's a good way to describe what she does.
All right. But she focuses on diseases, infectious diseases that jump from animals to humans, which I am fascinated by that. Like, you know, we may know, okay, we all probably think this happened once or twice, but there are cases, you know, where involving raccoons and involving other animals that you've seen infectious diseases jump to humans.
Yeah, the most obvious ones that maybe we don't really think of immediately, even though they're obvious, are mosquitoes, right? Mosquito-borne viruses like West Nile and malaria, which is obviously not a problem here, but West Nile is a big deal here. There's all kinds of interaction. And again, it's like, you know, one of the things I've learned from my wife is like the interconnectedness of the planet, right? Of the environment and humans and animals. You know, when we're now up in their space more than ever before, and she'll always remind me, we're intruding on their space. They're not intruding on our space more often than not. And because of that, like, you know, there's more emphasis on, listen, they need to be healthy, because if they're not healthy, it's going to be a problem for us too. So yeah, she has a super fascinating job, and I write about football, right? So that's like, we kind of balance each other out. She's a genius and I write about football.
Well, there's balance there. It's interesting when you guys walk into a room, I bet, that, you know, some people want to talk with you about college football and college sports or pro sports, and other people are really interested in picking your wife's brain. Like, that you know, that's a good dinner party couple to have at your dinner party. So congrats on that.
Yeah, I guess we do okay as far as that's concerned. She definitely, especially what, you know, after what we went through back in 2020, 2021, yeah, she was definitely a very popular person, getting a lot of texts of like, what's going on here?
All right, so the AP preseason ranking, you tweeted the rankings for the, you know, the 12-team CFP last year as they would have gone by the AP rankings, and two unranked teams in there. A number 15, a number 22. I hope it feels that wide open. What did you make when you saw the original poll, and kind of why did you look back and kind of look at other years?
Well, I just know that it's easy to fall into the trap of here are the teams that are going to be good. If you're predicting a playoff, here's who you should predict. Right? In other words, like, let me look at the top 15 teams. It'll probably be 11 of those teams in a group of five team, right? Like that's understandable. We get into this groupthink mentality, especially in college football, because the offseason is so long. And as much as the AP poll doesn't come out until a few weeks before the season, I mean, let's face it, John, like the college football media ecosystem has been ranking these teams since January 11th, right? We have way too early polls, and then, you know, post-spring, post-portal, then the computer rankings come out. So there's a bit of a groupthink and a narrative that develops, which is understandable. That's not being critical of our voters. But I think what we end up underestimating is how much we don't know and how much things will go sideways, and that there is going to be a couple of teams. I mean, every year there's at least one top 10 team that doesn't just not finish in the top 10, doesn't finish ranked at all. Like one to two top 10 teams usually wash out every year. Last year it was USC. So I think it's not a matter of me trying to determine, okay, this is, I'll be able to pick what the playoff teams are by looking through these patterns and seeing, you know, how many number 20 teams made it and how many number 12 teams made it. It's just a matter of sort of getting your mind in the space that there's going to be some stuff that we really don't see coming. So if you're smart, maybe try to, or if you want to have some fun predicting the season, watch a little bit, because at least some of that stuff is going to happen. Like, we don't know what's coming, but at least some stuff that we don't see, at least some of these teams that we think are good are not going to be good, and some of these teams that we're dismissing are going to end up having really good seasons.
Ralph Russo, Associated Press, is with us. I'm trying to gather how forgiving the regular season will be with the expanded playoff. In prior years.
That's a great way to put it, John. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
How forgiving do you...
You know, we're all learning here. And if you do look at some of these schedules, especially in the SEC and in the Big Ten, a little lesser extent than the other two Power Fours, but nonetheless, there's some bulking up that's gone on there. We are really recalibrating what success is in college football this year. And you can get very quickly to a place where you see a very good team has lost two or even three games. And what does that mean for playoff rankings and getting in the playoff? I think we almost get too caught up in playoff, playoff, playoff. I think it's just a mindset before. Like, we've grown up with college football is undefeated, or maybe you get one mulligan if you lose a game, right? That's sort of what the standard of great football. And I think just simply wrapping our minds around having a few more mulligans, what exactly does success mean? Having a stretch where, you know, I think Matt Rhule made a good point as far as talking about the Big Ten. People who gave him a little heat talking about it's like the NFL, but it is if you start thinking about the road trips and how that could cost you a game. Like, what does your schedule look like if you're going to the West Coast and then coming back, and maybe you have a noon game and that shortens your week? So I think we are recalibrating everything that we think about when it comes to success. And, I know the best answer, like, it's not a great answer to say I don't know, but we are entering such uncharted waters that I think I don't know. I'm really fascinated to figure out how this works, though.
I don't know how anybody would put anybody but Georgia at one, given kind of what they've done. So I have no beef there. Oregon at three. You know, as you wrote, you had a great piece where you kind of said what could go wrong for all these teams. You wrote, the buzz around Oregon seems aggressive. And I would agree with that, because I need to see Dan Lanning go and win a tough game. I need to see him beat Ohio State at home, or, you know, go to Michigan and win. And given that, you know, his losses have come against Georgia, Washington, Oregon State, I need to see him win some of those games.
Oh, no doubt. And listen, he's only been there 2 years. He's 39 years old, right? I mean, I think there's, we very quickly in today's culture, we rapidly get to, but can he win the big one? And, yeah, the guy's been, he's coached 28 games or something along those lines, right? Or 30 games, something like those, that. But I think it is a fair question, especially after the way Washington games went last year. I also think that when you sort of portal patch your secondary, it can be a little dicey. Listen, the players look good. The roster looks good. You're nitpicking. I think sometimes when I say, like, that feels a little aggressive at three, you know, the next question becomes, well, then who else are you going to have at three? And if I say, well, maybe I would be more comfortable with Texas at three, and maybe I would be a little more comfortable with Alabama or Ole Miss. And then as soon as I bring up Ole Miss, you're like, well, what? That's team portal, right? So it's easy for me to say, like, and maybe I would have the Ducks a spot or two lower, but somebody's got to be number three, and they make a pretty good case for it. So, again, I think you're right. I think that the feels aggressive has more to do with, like, I haven't quite seen this group do it, and now we are putting them in, like, very as close as possible to the Georgia Ohio State tier, which I think is a tier of itself.
The Miami Hurricanes feel poised to make some noise. I talked to Mario Cristobal maybe a month ago, and he just sounded a little different. Sounded like he was confident, kind of. There's a quiet confidence there. I like what he's done, obviously, with the portal and recruiting. Could they be a sneaky team this year? How do you see Miami?
Yeah, so I equate Miami to Texas last year, that they could be that team. And if you look at the trajectory, Sark comes in first year 5-7. Next year, it's 8-5. Now, a little better their second year. I think you could really see Texas was, like, on to something. But nonetheless, 8-5, you know, nobody was really getting on board the Sark train at 8-5. I think their year two was a little better than Miami's year two. Frankly, listen, I mean, if they kneel the ball, it really does color the whole season, that one loss. But let's take that aside. Like, they've been building a lot. Highly rated recruiting classes, building on the lines, which is something Texas was doing very well for the first couple of years there. All of a sudden, you looked at them up front, offensive and defensively, and you saw some grown men. So I wonder if Miami is a little of that trajectory, 5-7, 7-whatever, and all of a sudden in year three, it really clicks because you have all your players and it takes off. I think the big difference we have, you know, listen, Sark was, you know, 8-win Sark, right? Like, you know, like, you lived through it in Washington. A lot of people didn't think he was a guy who was going to ever break through. So maybe, you know, and Mario's got more success on his resume than Sark did previously. I could see the talent being so good at Miami this year that they just simply built it up and built it up the right way that, yeah, that there could be a big breakthrough coming. But I understand people looking with a little bit of skepticism.
What are you doing with Michigan? I'm looking at him, and I just kind of question, can you just keep it going, and what will the fallback be? And maybe I have the same question about Alabama. Let's talk about both of those. Kalen DeBoer at Alabama, yeah. Michigan in the wake of a national title. What are you doing with those programs?
Yeah, so let me. So on Michigan, at the beginning of the interview, we were talking about how every year at least one top 10 team washes out, and usually it's 1-2. It's like it's not that uncommon that you get two top 10 teams that don't finish ranked at all. If you ask me to pick which one, I would pick Michigan. And Michigan has three possible first-round draft picks. Their defense is going to be very, very good again. But there is just so much turnover on the coaching staff and on the roster. A number one draft pick quarterback. They're the likely starter there, I think, maybe. You know, haven't gotten a ton of information out of Michigan's silo, is a guy who's thrown one college pass. Now, Alex Orji is a freaky athlete, as our friend Bruce Feldman could tell you, but he's thrown one college pass. I could see a situation where the offense just is a real problem, and they're sort of just fighting by on defense and really struggling to score. And all of a sudden, again, getting back to our discussion about schedules and setting, you know, expectations and what is success, like it would be pretty easy to get three losses on that schedule. Now, does three losses still mean you're a ranked team? Well, what if you happen to lose another one? What if there's another one that gets away aside from just the Texas, Ohio State, and Oregon games, and now you slip up at a, I don't even know if they play Wisconsin, but I'm just going to throw Wisconsin or Iowa out there. Like, I just think that there's turnover when it comes to talent, but also turnover when it comes to culture and leadership and things along those lines. And it just seems like it's so much at Michigan. For Alabama, you know, the funny thing with Alabama, we've kind of taken two paths on them or taken a long road on them. I think there was a lot of panic about Alabama when a bunch of players started jumping in the portal back in February-ish and the first, you know, when DeBoer first got there. And then he seemed to stabilize things. They've had some good success on the recruiting trail, which of course doesn't mean anything for this year, but it's a positive for their long-term build. But I am with you thinking, like, are we now underrating the turnover at Alabama? Have we gone from being a little too skeptical about DeBoer to now thinking like, well, it'll just be like, you know, same as it ever was at Alabama, and he's going to crank out a, you know, an 11-1 season, and merrily they go along into playing for, you know, an SEC championship and maybe a national championship. There's still, you know, listen, Alabama's always got players. There's going to be some stars there that emerge, but I think it's fair to say that maybe we were a little too pessimistic in the first month, and maybe we've grown a little too optimistic as the season starts.
Yeah, and I think I look at that and I say Kalen DeBoer has won everywhere he's gone, and Alabama wins. You put him together, that should work.
Yeah.
But I don't know why I look at their schedule and I go 9-3. Would the wheels come off for that fan base at 9-3? And you know the rest of us go, hey man, that's what a coaching transition is in this era. But I don't know, Ralph, you're doing such a good job. But you know, give a fist bump to your wife who's doing the good work out there and fighting the fight that is helping keep people healthy. Appreciate you guys. Appreciate your work and you making time for us today.
Thank you, John. Anytime.
All right, there he goes, Ralph Russo, putting together a dinner party. Like, you know, if you're putting together like a dream dinner party based on the guests we've had on this show over the years, I'd put Ralph Russo and his wife on the dinner party list. And I'd sit him down there and people would go, well, what do you do? And he goes, well, I'm, you know, I, Ralph Russo, I cover college football for the Associated Press. And, you know, they'd sit, turn to his wife and say, oh, well, you know, what do you do? And she'd say, well, I'm a veterinarian and I work for the New York City. I work for the city of New York City and work for the Department of Health and I focus on infectious diseases and I'm an epidemiologist. And suddenly Ralph is sitting there and everybody's going, well, wait a minute. I have so many questions. I love that. Smart stuff. His wife is the subject of a story in The New Yorker. And Ralph tweeted it, and I was like, oh, let me check this out. And you know how you go down that rabbit hole? I did that. Next, we talk about the big splash. It's the one thing you need to know.